because even though it's this, so this is a course on gravitational physics, the current applications in string theory about there's a huge industry in applying gravity in string theory in the context of the gauge gravity correspondence. So I think it would be quite remiss of me not to discuss this particular important application of gravitational physics. So I'll start by talking more generally about gravity in higher dimensions, and in particular gravitating solutions in supergravity or supergravity as inspired by string theory. So I'm not really going to do any heavy-duty supergravity here. It's all going to be fairly familiar. We're just simply looking at black hole or black brain solutions. But this time, we'll be looking at instances where they're charged. So we'll sort of see how to generalize the concept of Reissner-Nordström to higher dimensions and to brains. And then towards the end, I'll sort of focus in on a particular solution of this, of type 2b supergravity, and motivate a discussion of anti-de Sitter space. So you've had a go in tutorials, I think. The higher dimensional Schwarzschild solution, is that right? That was one of the tutorials. So in arbitrary dimensions, capital D, you showed that the Schwarzschild potential generalized the Newtonian potential of 1 and r to 1 and r to the d minus 3. So that's like the delta function solution to a Laplacian in d minus 1 dimensions. And the mass of this solution is proportional to the so-called generalized Schwarzschild radius to the d minus 3. So it's proportional to the coefficient that's sitting on top of the r to the d minus 3 piece. So that generalizes the mass of the black hole, the ADM mass. Now, AD minus 2 here is just the area of this two-sphere here. So it's just a combinatorial factor. So I don't recall if we got you to calculate temperatures, but just in case. I'll write it down. So the temperature, which you can get fairly quickly by looking at the Euclideanized higher dimensional Schwarzschild, the temperature turns out to be proportional to the derivative of this potential at the horizon. And so that's just proportional to this factor of mass to the 1 over d minus 3. And then the entropy is going to be proportional to the area of this d minus 2 sphere. And so that is proportional to r plus to the d minus 2. And so that's proportional to a power of m. So we've already seen this, that for the black string, yesterday we noted that the entropy went like m squared, where m was the sort of four-dimensional Schwarzschild mass, whereas the entropy of the hyperspherical black hole in five dimensions went like m to the 3/2. So you see that this sort of dimension-dependent proportionality coming in here. So this is just a straightforward generalization of a black hole. So I'll talk about charges in a minute, but before that, just highlight the fact that although this has sort of been implicit, I think, when I've been discussing the gravitational or metrics and their Ricci curvature, we've also seen extended solutions. So yesterday, we looked in particular at the black string in five dimensions. But more generally, I'm not thinking about charges here. If we're just thinking about vacuum gravity, we can split our big D dimensional space into sort of two parts, one completely flat part and a part that looks like a black hole. So when we were looking at the Ricci tensor of general metrics, we saw that provided, if we're in vacuum Einstein gravity, we could always replace some of the dimensions. If this started off being like a Minkowski space-time, we could replace some subset of the dimensions, the flat metric there, with an Einstein solution, a vacuum Einstein solution. So this that I've written down here represents a... So this would be a D minus D dimensional extended. So, sorry, that's D minus D brain, because it's got D minus D spatial directions. So that's also going to be unstable for a similar reason that the black string is unstable. But, of course, all I've written down here are vacuum solutions, right? So it would be a bit annoying if all of the extended or all of the vacuum solutions were unstable. So what happens in stringy supergravity? So all I've written here is vacuum Einstein gravity, which is actually not quite the setup that we have. So I'm just going to write a sort of generic type of action. (Clears which is meant to schematically represent the fact that there's a sort of core content of the supergravity, which is the an Einstein-Hilbert type expression. So it's really scalar tensor. You see there's that conformal factor there, e to the minus 2 phi. And then there's also this HABC, which I'll define in a moment. But then there can also be additional fields. And I'm going to focus on the case where those are just simply P-form fields. So AP is meant to represent a P-form field. So here, HABC is the exterior derivative of a two-form gauge potential, and the two-form can be interpreted as the gauge field under which the string carries charge. And then the AP is a P-form gauge field. So what does that really mean? It just means that the gauge transformation would be AP goes to AP plus D of some P minus 1 form. So it's exactly analogous to a gauge transformation in electromagnetism. And so you can ask, these are just sort of general fields. We know we've dealt with forms, so we know what they are. And we know how to find energy momentum tensors of forms. We also know how to vary that action to get gravitational field equations. So we can deal with finding classical solutions to this action. Let me just talk about roughly, you know, what they look like qualitatively. The general solutions, this form, this part of the space, if you look at it, if C was just R, then it would look like if I redefine my variables, it kind of looks like this part of a black hole metric. So it's like the space surrounding an object. So it's transverse to the gravitating object. So you think about these D minus N minus 2 spheres as sort of surrounding some point in the center. But of course, that point is really extended because it has this more like a black hole type metric. Sorry, this object here, this Xn, so in the case of the black hole, there's no dxn here, and that's because it's a hole, it's a point-like object. It has no extent. But if you remember when we looked at the cosmic string metric in four dimensions, the cosmic string metric had a radial coordinate. It had a single angular coordinate, so this was just like d phi squared or d theta squared. And then it had, as well as a time direction, it had another coordinate representing the length of the string. And so that was an example where you would have an extended solution where this coordinate here represents the dimension in which the object is extended. So if I kind of sketch what I mean here, I'm thinking I've got a gravitational solution. A depends, all of these functions depend only on rho. So they don't depend on t or n. So we have a translational symmetry in those x directions and also a translational symmetry in time. So this is the representation of this gravitating object. So if we have a horizon, then the horizon exists all over this plane here. Then transverse to this brain, we've got the rho direction. And then also surrounding the brain, we've got the SD minus N minus 2, the sphere surrounding this object. So again, it might help to think of that string analogy where we have the string sort of pointing up in the Z direction. So that would be this along. This would be a single direction, single space-like direction. The string exists in time, so it's sweeping out a world sheet. Meanwhile, it has a two-dimensional plane transverse to it, and so that would be a rho and a single angular direction. So there are two options for charging. And they're analogous. We use the same phrase that we get from electromagnetism in four dimensions, and they're basically electric and magnetic charge. So if the brain has electric charge, then what that means is I have a... Let me make sure I get this the right way around. I've got an N. I've got an N plus 1 form gauge potential. Which depends on the radial direction. And in particular, it has a component in the t direction and a component along every single one of these x's. So an electric charge is something where there's a T component in the gauge field. The magnetic charge is more topological in nature. I've done that in 10 dimensions, so I think I mean. And in this case, it means that there is a D minus 3 minus N form, if you wanted to think of it that way. But in particular, you have a field strength which completely sort of envelops the sphere of that transverse space. So I think this is easiest to see in the context of four-dimensional electromagnetism, from which these two terms come. So I've already drawn the analogy with the electric case. So an electric charge would be where F was something like Q on R squared, if you're in flat space, I guess, dt cross dr, still the same. Whereas the magnetic magnetic charge would be that F was Q times the volume on the unit 2 sphere, which is sine theta d theta d phi. So that's saying that F theta phi is just Q sine theta. Now, both of those charges in four-dimensional straight Einstein gravity or Einstein-Maxwell gravity, both of those charges give the same energy momentum tensor, and both of them have the same gravitational solution, which is the Riesen and Nordström solution. And so the general structure of the solution is that it's a quadratic polynomial in 1 and r, and so it has two roots. So the Riesen and Nordström solution is something which has an inner and an outer event horizon, and you can see that the charge is related to the product of the two horizons, r plus r minus. And so the other property that you notice about the electromagnetism, or these black holes, the electric and magnetic black holes, and the reason, if you like, why they have the same gravitational solution, is that the electric F is simply the dual of the magnetic F. And so your energy momentum tensor, you know, it's composed of these products of F, which turn out to be kind of the same, whether you're dealing with F or F dual. And so this pattern, it's a little more complicated when you've got that scalar, the dilaton, hanging around. But this notion of an invariance of equations of motion under this type of duality transformation kind of persists when you go to higher dimensions. So you can, if you found one solution, if you found, for example, a magnetic solution, then you know that you've got, for free, a dual electric solution for some different P-form charge. So it's kind of saves a little bit of work sometimes when looking for solutions. So the So you have a similar picture with the string action, but perhaps the duality transformation is just a little bit modified. So you you find these electric solutions. So you find these sort of pairs of solutions. It's this sort of general shape. Now, four dimensions and electromagnetism are kind of special because you can really, from the point of view of the Riesz and Nordström gravitational potentials, or in other words, the geometry, you can't really tell whether it's sourced by an electric or magnetic field without going and measuring the Maxwell stress tensor and deciding, do I have an electric field at infinity or do I have a magnetic field at infinity? So the geometry it doesn't really care which of those it is. And so you get this, the real reason is that because F is a two-form is dual to a two-form in four dimensions.
Mm-hmm. Just to make the connection between your third board and the second board.
Yes.
If I look at the metric that says d squared is a d t squared and so on, I have to make a redefinition from r to rho in order to...
Oh, right, for the Riesz and Nordström. Yes, 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 yes.
Mm-hmm. And then the xn directions will always be flat?
No, there's no dxn. So here... If you look at 4D electromagnetism, here we've got, so when I'm talking about Riesz and Nordström here, so this is D is 4, right?
Yeah.
And then we've got a two-form stress tensor. So in the electric case, we're looking at a one-form gauge potential. So in this case, N is 0, so there's no X's, so it's a point, it's a zero brain. And in the second case, for the magnetic charge, we're looking at a two-sphere. So in this case, D minus 2 minus N, except that's probably... So we're looking at the volume on a two-sphere. I think I've got my... Never trust anyone to do simple arithmetic. It's a disaster. So here it's a two-sphere that this F has to be. And so once again, if D is 4 and your D minus 2 gives you 2, the N is 0. So again, we've got N is 0. So N is D minus 2 minus 2. So if we looked at electromagnetism, as I said, four dimensions were special for electromagnetism because a two-form is dual to a two-form. If you were in five dimensions with electromagnetism, So if you looked at electromagnetism in 5D, then the electric solution would still be a point because it's still just a one-form gauge potential. However, the magnetic solution now, it's still going to be a two-form, q sine theta d phi, but now if I have a d omega 2 there, I've got to actually have an extended direction. So I'm going to have n equals 1. And so the magnetic solution is now a string in five dimensions. So you've got a notion of a single extra dimension, x, and surrounding this string is the rho direction, and then a two-sphere. So adding, totting up the numbers, you've got a three-dimensional transverse space, a single dimension running along the string, and then time, so that's five dimensions. So the magnetic solution is now five-dimensional. One-dimensional. And if I were to go to six dimensions, the magnetic solution would now be two-dimensional, and so on and so forth. So in particular, in 10 dimensions, something like this, a magnetic solution, would actually have six spatial directions. So I guess when I say two-dimensional, I mean two spatial dimensions. So you end up with a whole range of solutions to this gravitational action, which are extended. They look a bit like black holes, but they're charged. So they either have electric or magnetic charges based on that two-form field strength, which gives you the H as its three-form, or those additional AP, P-form fields. For one of these solutions to be self-dual, in the sense that you can have the electric and magnetic charges, sort of there's a, you know, the single solution could be electrically or magnetically charged. You need to have, first of all, you obviously need an even number of dimensions, and then you need to have the field strength having the right dimensionality. So in other words, you need a D on 2 form. So a particularly important example, if we're dealing with this 10-dimensional low-energy effective action, is something called the D3 brain. So I'm just sort of pegging this has to be in a particular brand, that's depending on what families of additional gauge fields you have, that's something which comes from which particular type of string theory you're looking at. And this particular brand is 2B. And so this solution So again, I'm not using the row. I'm rewriting it in the sort of standard gauge that... So these solutions were found by Horowitz and Strominger, and this would be a more standard gauge in which if you were trying to do something analogous to looking for the Schwarzschild solution, this would be what you would find. Let me just try and explain what we've got here. This omega 5 here, this is the S5, which is part of the transverse space. So this is the sphere surrounding the brain in the transverse space. Whereas this other part, so this bit here, is the brain, the D3 brain directions. So this is the D3 brain. And the epsilon 5 that I've drawn, this is, I suppose you could think of it as this giving you the volume form on the 5 sphere, giving you, this is what this is, might represent. And then the dual of that is the volume on this other, the rest of the dimensions. So that's a manifestly self-dual solution. The five-form field strength F is self-dual. If I take star of F, I'm going to get F again. And the metric doesn't care about whether it's coming from an electric or a magnetic type of source. And so it just sees the field strength and that charge Q. So the Q, like with Reisner-Nordström, or analogous to it, Q is a product of the two horizons. So you've got, again, an R plus and an R minus. And the D3 brain itself, the actual real D3 brain, is the extremal limit of the solution where R plus goes to R minus. So the two horizons of Reisner-Nordström, in general, are separate, but there's a very special limit where the charge becomes large enough that the two horizons coincide. And so you end up with just simply R minus R plus squared on R squared. So that's a particular limit known as an extremal limit for the black hole. And so in this case, you see we've got two horizons. Well, rather, we've got two potentially singular points, R plus and R minus. And if we set the two to be equal, again, that's a special point in the solution space. So in order to write it down, let me just change coordinates. going to set, just simply redefine my radial coordinate. So what you see here is a particular pattern that seems to crop up quite a lot when in these sort of gravity-type solutions. In string theory, this F is just interpreted like a warp factor. So you can see that, for example, as rho goes to zero, F becomes very large. And so you've got this sort of uneven weighting of distances between the parallel directions and this transverse space. and then also notice that this is just, this thing sitting in here is really just 6D flat, okay, in polar coordinates. And so once again, I could replace that Euclidean flat space with any sort of flat Einstein manifold. So that's something else that you might see. So Ricci flat. But what I just want to, and I'm really not going to say it in any great detail, the R plus is given, or this Schwarzschild radius, if you like, if you can think of it as a Schwarzschild radius, this metric is generated by things which are charged under that F field. And those things, they're called D-brains for a specific reason, because they have an interpretation from the string theory context as surfaces on which open strings can end. And the D comes from Dirichlet, which is a Dirichlet boundary condition, just saying something is fixed as opposed to Neumann boundary conditions. So that's why these things get called D-brains. And so in this case, it was sort of realized that some of these supergravity solutions could be sort of reinterpreted as being actual objects which had a completely alternative description coming from the world sheet side, the string theory side. And so these D-brains are endpoints of open strings. And so from a stringy perspective, they have a different interpretation. And so their interpretation is in terms of a gauge field theory. From the gravitational perspective, it's just like if you have, let's say, an extremal Reissner-Nordström black hole, you can actually superpose extremal Reissner-Nordström black holes because the gravitational attraction between the black holes is balanced by the electrostatic repulsion. And so you could imagine having a single Reissner-Nordström, having two, one on top of the other, a charge two, a charge three, a charge four, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's what this N is here. It's like the number of these D3 brains sitting on top of each other. So this is the sort of gravitational side of what is known as ADS-CFT, in the sense that if I have a very large number of these brains all sitting on top of each other, the dominant part of my F, this is a very schematic type of argument is the part that depends on rho. And if I just take that part, then I would rewrite my metric . So this is just an S5 of unit of a fixed radius, and this is ADS5. So gravitationally, what I've got is an anti-de Sitter space with some fixed sphere going along for the ride, and that's my gravitational supergravity solution. And so this is really, this is sort of like a gravitational way of seeing the gauge gravity correspondence. So let me just finish off by talking a little bit about, this is really just meant to motivate, talking about anti-de Sitter space and some of the things that you can do in anti-de Sitter space. So Anna, is it a tutorial or a homework on anti-de Sitter space?
No, I didn't really do anything.
Oh, you didn't? Okay, because I thought.
Well, we did ADS black holes on Wednesday, but we didn't really talk much about ADS.
Okay. So there's a little bit of familiarity with ADS, but not a lot. Well, anti-de Sitter space, actually, it's a hyperbolic space. So what that means is it's completely negatively curved. And from a gravitational perspective, you'd see it as a solution to Einstein's equations with a negative cosmological constant. So for an awfully long time, anti-de Sitter space was not really looked at, particularly from the perspective of gravitational physics, because it's a solution with a negative cosmological constant. So that means that to source it, you've got to somehow have a source that has a negative energy. And so it was felt to be unphysical. The other thing with anti-de Sitter space is that it's got a slightly odd, I guess, causal structure or interpretation. De Sitter space can be represented as a hyperboloid in one dimension higher up, but still with a single time, whereas anti-de Sitter space, if you represent it as some surface in a higher dimensional space, actually ends up with two times. And so in some sense, anti-de Sitter space has it looks like it has closed time-like curves. And so what we end up doing with anti-de Sitter space is usually taking a sort of universal covering and so that we don't end up with things like closed time-like curves. Now, the other thing that you notice when you start playing with anti-de Sitter space is there's loads of different ways of coordinatizing it. So you would have looked at, I guess, black holes in the universal or the global coordinate system. In other words, where you have something like an r squared d omega squared, yep. So in this case, notice that the way I've said that's anti-de Sitter space, and it's actually, we've already met this way, way back, I think in the first week, where I was looking at starting to compute curvature tensors using the Cartan formalism. And I think my first example was something I called a warp, or maybe the second example, was a warp compactification, where I simply had a d rho squared, and then I had some factor multiplying a flat space. And the solution that we, or at least one remark I made, was that you could have this warp factor being e to the minus k rho, where I remarked that was anti-de Sitter space. So in that case, that would just simply redefine our rho coordinate there. If you see that if you set rho as something like e to the kz, then you're going to have a dz squared, and you're going to have an exponential warp factor pre-multiplying the other part. But in particular, it's flat. The dt squared minus dx squared is flat, okay? So that's sort of, there's different ways of coordinatizing anti-de Sitter space. And the reason is it's got a huge degree of symmetry. So it has an enormous symmetry group, which means that you can choose, take all sorts of different choices of coordinates, and there's different sort of time-like killing vectors, which mean that you slice your space in a variety of ways. Now, if you've got pure anti-de Sitter space, it doesn't make very much difference. But if you start looking at black holes, then you find out that it does. Now, you've looked at the spherically symmetric black hole. But if I look at this, which is meant to be this near horizon limit of this D3 brain, I could say, well, let me look at a planar black hole. When I talked about black holes, I said that you could have planar black holes in anti-de Sitter space. So I'm in five dimensions. I'll just stick with five dimensions. So if you remember the potential, the Schwarzschild potential that we had over here, this one came from the fact that we were dealing with something which had an SD minus 2. So in the planar case, the one vanishes. And if we had a cosmological constant, then you had something like plus or minus h squared r squared. So here, in the pure anti-de Sitter, you can see this is the equivalent of the h squared r squared term. And so I've simply added the r plus on r to the d minus 3. D is 5 here, so that's just r plus on or mu on rho squared. So there's a horizon here at rho plus is mu l squared to the 1/4. So that's my horizon. And then my temperature, well, the temperature is just given by the derivative of this potential over 4 pi. So I take the derivative and evaluate at rho plus. But then I know that at rho plus, mu on rho plus squared is rho plus squared on L squared. So I know that this is simply 1 over pi. Rho plus on L squared. Now, I'm not really interested in the L here. What I wanted to remark is now we know mu is somehow related to the mass of the black hole. Notice that now mu and T are appearing as directly proportional. So here my mass is proportional to T to the fourth. So I now have a positive specific heat. And so my black hole is thermodynamically stable. So the spherically symmetric black hole was a little more like Schwarzschild, although it was quite interesting. Did they manage to get through to sort of finding the walking page or not? So the larger the black hole got when it was spherically symmetric, eventually it became thermodynamically stable. And that's kind of consistent with this, because the bigger the black hole gets, the more like the event horizon kind of, you know, for a small black hole, it's kind of quite got a very small radius of curvature. But for large black holes, it starts to look more and more planar. And so here we're seeing that the planar black hole is thermodynamically stable. And so that's kind of consistent with what you found for the round black holes. Another interesting thing. Is what happens to a scalar field in ADS. So let's just look at a massive scalar and its equation of motion. Now, I can write down the equation of motion in those planar coordinates, but let me change variables to x, which is proportional to 1 on rho, and write phi as some power of x times a new scalar field chi, then leaving it as an exercise. So my chi here is going to have an e to the I omega t minus ik dot x type of dependence. Okay, so why did I write it this way? When you're looking at the properties of a scalar field, you usually separate variables and try and look at, you know, what happens to the eigenfunctions of the solution to your wave equation, because that's how you construct the propagator. You're just finding a Green's function. So in this case, what I've done is I've used the symmetries of the background to do the standard sort of frequency decomposition for my scalar field. And then I'm focusing in on the radial eigenfunction equation. And the reason for doing this change of variables here was because what I wanted to do was to get this into a format which is just a Bessel equation. So what I need to do as always is to find a basis of solutions to my wave equation. And I want to make sure I've written it in a self-adjoint form so I can correctly identify the basis. So what I've done here is I've got a Bessel equation. So now I know that I can go ahead and find the correct basis to expand my radial eigenfunctions in. But notice this piece. So this is basically well-defined. So in other words, I have positive frequency solutions. Provided this is positive. Now, in flat space, you would just have a mass squared term here. So in flat space, you'd just be saying that the mass was positive. But here, I'm telling you that I can have good solutions, provided that the mass is positive. provided my mass is bigger than some negative value. So in other words, I can actually have sensible scalar field theories with a negative mass on anti-de Sitter space. So that's something that's kind of weird about anti-de Sitter space, but incredibly useful. That's known as a Brighton-Lohner-Friedman bound. And this is a sort of quick and dirty way to get to it. So the anti-de Sitter space, you know, being negatively curved, has all sorts of weird properties. If you start sort of looking at geodesics in anti-de Sitter space, you'll see that a time-like geodesic is kind of always trapped. It's always going to stay within the sort of bulk or interior of the anti-de Sitter space. And that's kind of the reason why you have this sort of feature of negative masses being allowed. Because normally the reason a negative mass isn't allowed is because it represents an instability. Your scalar field's kind of going to start to roll off the top of its potential. And so you see that by finding solutions which have sort of are like waves in space, but exponentially growing in time. And they have a characteristic wavelength set by the negative mass. Whereas here, because things in anti-de Sitter space get trapped, if the wavelength of the instability is too big, it kind of doesn't fit within this hyperbolic space. So the hyperbolic space is like a confining box. And so that's kind of the physical reason why you get this particular situation. And so the properties of anti-de Sitter space, such as having sensible negative mass scalar fields, can then be used to construct all sorts of interesting additions to this pure gravitational anti-de Sitter space. So in ADS-CFT, a lot of the time on the gravitational side, people are adding in additional fields and then looking at when you can have non-trivial gravitational solutions with additional fields. Those non-trivial solutions then have some particular fall off at infinity, and that then has an interpretation in terms of this sort of stringy side, the dual field theory, and operators in a dual field theory. So there's some quite interesting gravitational physics going on by starting to look at anti-de Sitter space in detail and looking at the properties of fields on anti-de Sitter space. So I encourage those that are interested to go out and at least have a look at some of the literature and some of the things that people are currently doing in ADS-CFT, because actually an awful lot of it is just gravity. So you're now in a position to be able to at least attack that side of the literature, and hopefully if you do a string theory course, you'll have an idea of the other side. So, thanks.